South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right. Well, a very good morning. Another beautiful day here across South Texas in the Hill Country. Not cool by any means, but not hot either. It's just all that humidity, but golly, considering that this is the first day of May, it's just not bad out there. It's going to be a beautiful day to garden. It's going to be a beautiful day to work with your houseplants. It's going to be a beautiful day to be outside, whatever you happen to be doing. And that's what we're here to talk about for the next 3 hours. Looks like three of the four lines are taken with Mark from Houston, Mark from Fredericksburg, and Thomas leaves one open. Grab it if you like. You just heard the number, 210-599-5555. And why don't we start out over Houston way? Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, sir. I hope you're doing well.
I'm off to a good start. Have the pleasure of unloading a part of a semi at 6:30 this morning, so I am wide awake. We don't even have to follow the old adage that the nice thing about radio is you only have to sound awake. You don't have to look awake. I think I actually probably look awake this morning. So my day's off to a good start. What about you?
Well, I'm grateful for being vertical once again. So
that's the best place to start. Frankly, although sometimes would rather be horizontal, but just with the opportunity to become vertical at our choice of times.
Well, I figure at my age, if I can become vertical on my own, that's a good day.
Well, I'll take your word for that.
Okay. I have three questions if there is time to ask them.
You go right ahead.
Okay, in terms, we bought some starting potatoes, starter potatoes. Or, mm-hmm. What are they actually called?
Is that seed potatoes.
Seed potatoes.
Okay. Yeah.
Got seed potatoes. Didn't all get into the ground, unfortunately.
Uh-huh.
And, so we're thinking about holding them over for the fall planting and some of them have almost like a bush of eyes on them. Should they be put in a paper bag in the refrigerator? How should they be stored?
Well, in all honesty, it's probably not worth the effort, but what you need to do is pack them in something loose and dry. Some growers use sawdust, some people use perlite. Then, you know, package them up in a paper bag or whatever, but then that paper bag would need to go inside of a plastic bag. The problem with our modern refrigerators, if you can call it a problem, is that the humidity is so low. That's what makes them frost-free. And if you just put them in there without being sealed up in something, they're going to shrivel up and be absolutely nothing left in 4 or 5 months when you think about planting them again. If you want to go to the trouble, like I say, very, very gently, pack them up. How many of them are there that you're looking at protecting?
I've got about four. I don't know how many Wendy has.
Okay. You could, again, a big Ziploc bag would do well. At a very minimum, if it's more than that, it'll fit in a gallon Ziploc or two. I guess you could use just a small plastic garbage bag or something like that. But sealing them up in something moisture proof is going to be critical if you're going to have anything left of them. You're going to a lot of work for $2 worth of potatoes, but you know, on the other hand, seed potatoes are sometimes hard to find in the fall, so if you want to do it, go for it.
Well, we had a lot of trouble finding seed potatoes this time around. We had to go into Alvin, I think, from Houston to get them, and it's just the thought of being able to relight, put new life into them.
Well, it's always good. Sad to say, but sometimes you just have to get them online or else drive some distance. The thing about seed potatoes, they are certified to be free from the diseases that potatoes can sometimes get. And the potatoes that go into the grocery stores, they have gotten pretty efficient at killing the dormant eyes on the potatoes. You know, years ago you bought potatoes, and if you didn't bake them the first week, they started sprouting in your pantry. Nowadays, and the main thing they do, thankfully, rather than do it chemically, is they flash freeze them. They hit them with very cold air just long enough to kill the eyes, but not enough to freeze or ruin the potato. But by all means, again, if you want to store them, there's nothing wrong with that. Just pack them in something that'll keep those eyes from getting broken, then putting it in something that will seal them against the dehydration.
Okay, I guess straw would not be a good medium for doing that.
If you've got good, clean straw that you're sure didn't have any herbicides sprayed on it when it was grown, that would be just fine.
Okay.
Now, in your area, pine straw is also widely available, and that would be fine, too.
Okay. Got that written down. Second question is, I was moving some dirt that had a tree. Unfortunately, I just don't remember the name of it. It's the kind that grows like a weed and has those pretty fluffy yellow flowers on the ends that droop down.
Okay. It could be straggler daisy or one of several others, but yes, sir.
Yeah. And as I was digging, I was going to transfer that into a larger pot that already had some dirt in it to plant some other stuff. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of the desiccated bark that was in there, or the roots. And uh-huh. I didn't pay much attention to them. And as I was moving them, I saw some black things with wings kind of crawling uh-huh. around the dirt. And I'm guessing those are termites. So if that's correct, is there anything I can mix in there to kill the termites, or do I need to just throw all the dirt away somewhere?
No. Do not throw the dirt away. You've got a choice. If you wanted to mix some DE, diatomaceous earth, in there, that would do the job. If you simply wanted to mix a little orange oil with water and drench the pot with that, that would take care of any... You know, termites are basically winged ants, and what you're seeing, if they were black rather than white, they're probably ants rather than termites, but they're still not something you're anxious to have in the pots. But if it were me, I'd just take a 2-gallon watering can, put an ounce of orange oil in there, and just water that pot thoroughly and know that I'd taken care of the pill bugs, the millipedes, the ants, and every other form of non-beneficial life that was in there. And that's what would be easy. On the other hand, if you just want to take a cup of diatomaceous earth, mix it thoroughly with the soil, that will probably take care of them as well.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll try to do both with some time spread apart so the orange oil doesn't ruin the DE.
Well, whatever's easy for you.
Okay. Boy, yeah, once again, at my age, easy is a really, really good term. The third question is, you had something else to say?
Oh, I was just thinking, as I was unloading that semi this morning, the driver and I were talking about relative ages, and I was quoting to him a quote from an old friend that wrote a hiking guide to a part of Wyoming that I love to hike, and his comment was, "We do not stop hiking because we grow old. We grow old because we stop hiking." So you keep on using that body, and it'll keep on letting you use it. So it's not a bad thing.
You know, I agree with that 100%. But I guess then this morning, with unloading, you don't have to go to the gym to work out, right?
My gym is called Shades of Green Nursery, plus a few hundred acres in the hill country that I live on. So it's been a while since I went to the gym.
Okay, good. The final question is, and I went to the popular internet,
uh-huh.
and to ask this question, and I wasn't specific on a garden center, and in a single screen, it alternated between yes and no. The question is, does peppermint repel bees?
Peppermint repels many insects, but I can't say that it, I don't know. I've never really looked at it. I think if it were concentrated, as in the oil of peppermint, that probably would be repellent to bees. Just peppermint growing in a given space probably would not. I mean, there's very little that would draw bees to peppermint because the flowers are very nondescript, and peppermint doesn't really repel anything that a bee is looking for. If you were trying to repel bees, I don't think you could do it with a pot of peppermint, but if you went to, any place that had concentrated essential oils, the strong essence of peppermint would probably repel most flying insects.
Well, we're not interested in repelling the bees. We are wanting to repel stink bugs and things like that, stuff that attacks blackberries, for one.
Sure,
and
sure.
And know that the blackberries need bees, and I was just wondering if a mixture of peppermint, not peppermint plants, but mixing some peppermint with a spray would do the job without...
I doubt that it would really repel them. What I would probably do is spray in the afternoon or evening rather than in the morning, because bees are always most active before 10 o'clock in the morning. I think if you sprayed in the evening, you would accomplish your job of getting rid of the undesirables, and most of that aroma, whatever we want to call it, would have dissipated by morning. So I think if you followed that regimen, you would probably be just fine. Now, we don't have, our bee population seemed to be pretty low. I've just probably seen a tenth of the normal number of honeybees that I would see at this time of the spring. So don't assume that you've run the bees off if you don't see a lot of them. There may just not be a whole lot of them out there to see. I would tell you at some point, read up on what are called mason bees, or sometimes called cedar bees. They are a native solitary bee. They don't live in colonies, and we have like 100 different species here in Texas, and they are actually more efficient pollinators than honeybees are, and there are a number of things you can do to attract them to the area of your garden, and you might want to read up on that and look at how you can construct a simple little mason bee a colony, well, since they're not really a colony, but a mason bee attractor, and all you really need is an old chunk of cedar, either an old cedar tree or a piece of western red cedar. Drill a bunch of holes in it from 3/8 to 5/8 of an inch in diameter to 3 inches deep into the wood. Hang it out in a shady place, and you can bring lots of mason bees into your garden, which are going to do a better job than a honeybee of pollinating for you.
We have, or I have in my house, I think Wendy has at her house, one. I've got two of those mason bee houses.
Good. Very good. Well, you're off to a good start, and you're doing it right, Mark.
No, great. Thank you again, Mr. Educator. Appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure. You have a great day in the big city of Houston, and we will talk again. And right now, let's see. Mark, hang on a second. I don't want to get behind on these commercials. Let me do a real quick one, and then we'll head to Fredericksburg for our second. Mark, I get to talk to you about Southwest Metal Roofing Systems, and it's just a pleasure talking about a company that does such a good job, and I love sending people to them. So many people actually call me back and say, thank you for telling me about Southwest Metal Roofing Systems. You know, a roof from Southwest Metal Roofing Systems costs very little more than a shingle roof. And the difference is it's going to last a lifetime. Those shingles are going to last from 7 to 12 years, depending on the weather, or they might last 7 days if we get a nice big hailstorm. Well, if you've got a roof from Southwest Metal Roofing Systems, you simply stop worrying. They have the best warranty in the industry because they never have to come out and do anything. Our roof here at Shades of Green stood up to baseball-size hail, and you have to work hard to find the tiniest little dimple in it. My roof at my home has been on for, I guess, about 20 years now. Never called them once with a problem. If you want the roof that will save you money on your insurance, save you money on your utility bills, look good 365 days a year, and give you peace of mind when it comes to storm damage, well, the number to call is 210-822-6868. That's 210-822-6868 for Southwest Metal Roofing Systems.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening on this beautiful Sunday morning and up to the hill country. Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Bob.
Good morning. How are you, sir?
Okay, we were lucky. We were under the right cloud last week, and we got an inch and a half of rain.
Oh, man, you were. I was out of town a good deal of last week, and I was very surprised. I actually got 58 one-hundredths, which was a lot more than I expected. So I got a half or a third of what you did, but I'm thankful. Have your hummingbirds come back?
Yeah. So the last couple of years, the numbers have been way down.
Uh-huh.
Last, you know, we had 2,000 4 years ago, and last year maybe 800, and this year it's even less.
Well, I think all of them are not here yet, and I'm sad to say I think that a lot of them came back too early 2 years ago and got hit with that big freeze, because we've seen the same things with songbirds, you know, not just with hummingbirds, but that
right.
February single digits, or you guys were below zero. Unfortunately, a lot of migratory creatures, including bats, had come back, and it was lethal to them.
One of the things is the mealy blue sage didn't bloom until we got that little bit of rain.
Yeah.
And so it was very late.
Yep.
And that's why we have so many of them here, because it's everywhere out here, the mealy blue sage.
Oh, yeah. Well, so Mark and Diane are keeping the buffet very well filled and ready for them. But anyway, well, I was just curious about that. How can I help you this morning?
Well, just quickly, first, we're in the fight of our life with this oak wilt.
Yeah.
I told you several weeks ago, it was too close to the yard for us to trench and
right.
keep it out of the yard. And we've got like 12 to 16, 36 to 48 inch live oaks.
Right. And this drought is so bad, too. You know, I've seen good evidence of the cornmeal, you know, stopping it. But boy, when it gets dry like this, it hardly has time to do a whole lot, because that's what oak wilt does. It plugs up the vessels that transport the water from the roots of the tree up to the top of the tree. And when there's very little water to begin with, you're right. It is a real tough situation.
It knocked out two groves very quickly in the late fall and winter, like really fast.
Yep. And they call them moths, but anywhere that you can water, that will certainly help.
I'm doing that. Yeah.
Good.
And I told you that we didn't really have really good luck with the cornmeal, so
yeah.
At this point we're having to count on the Alamo to save like 30 to 40 inch trees.
You realize all it does is suppress the symptoms. It doesn't stop it from spreading further.
Right.
And be prepared to repeat it in about 3 years.
Right. That's part of the. We've been talking to two or three of the top experts that have the most experience. Anyhow, we had to cut two water lines, two fences, and the whole power to our shop to trench. And then I had to put a whole new power line in the ground.
Wow.
Anyway, it's been a mess. So. Couple things though. I use the pressure compensating drip hose, and the last couple years we very closely put it down and spaced it out, and I planted my carrots in between it in the one garden that has really good dirt. So we've been dripping it with this drip hose, but I got to thinking, most of these things that are real sun proof or sun resistant have lead in them. Do you think having the lead in that drip hose would be a problem for carrots growing in there?
No. And you've got more background metal in the ground, including arsenic and, you know, even radon, or the things that cause radon up sitting on the granite where you are. No, any lead that's in there is going to be, you know, totally tied up. If it were in the ground, it's not something that would be absorbed into the plants. Now, sadly, the you know, the little connectors are not as sun resistant. I've had, I find that they get quite brittle over time. So I usually put a shovel full of dirt over the T's and L's and things like that, because that hose goes for years, but those little connectors tend to get brittle after a year or two. I don't know if you've discovered that, if you actually leave them up on the surface. I find, and it just really depends on the soil that you are in, but if your soil is loose and open, you can get away with burying the drip hose. But if you're in a heavy clay soil, I'm finding that the drip hose doesn't function as well when it's buried. And I'm sure it's just that clay kind of seals over where the water comes out. And I'm telling people, in a heavy clay soil, leave the drip hose on the surface and it works great. But where you are, you can probably get away with burying it. And, of course, you can just judge by the success of your garden there.
We've always left it on the surface and mulched it largely with leaves, and or now we have about 200 cubic yards of tree mulch already from the storm.
Yeah,
so
well,
we put that on the surface. Now
you're
the,
doing
the
it right.
The Rainbird drip hose, does that use a pressure fitting, or is it the fittings we use now are the screw-on type?
The fittings are, you know, should just be totally open. The pressure compensating part of that tube is actually a little, and if, I'm sure you've probably cut open a hose and look at it, but that little bitty piece of plastic that's, you know, an inch long that's underneath each hole, that is what does the pressure compensating. You do not want to reduce the pressure in the hose itself.
No, what I'm saying, that the T's and the L's, how do they fasten on?
The ones we use are just, they're barbed. You just warm the hose up and push it in.
Yeah, I've had those where they just popped open. There's actually three different sizes of half-inch drip hose that are very close to a half-inch, and if you didn't use exactly the right size. But we use these kinds that have you push it over the fitting, and then it screws tight onto it.
Okay, well, that will work fine. I buy the ones that Rainbird makes that are made for that particular hose, and man, I can't pull them out if I wanted to. If you find that you made a mistake, you have to cut it off and slice the drip hose in order to get the fitting back out of it. So I haven't discovered that, but I'm glad to know there's a solution for that if somebody does have that problem.
Yeah. So next thing, so there doesn't seem to be a high quality watering wand the DRAM ones, eventually they all develop a pinhole.
Oh, yeah.
Have you had any luck, I've looked for years, actually, and never found another brand, really.
No, I haven't either. You could make your own if you wanted to. You know, a couple of fittings wouldn't look very good, but you could make one out of Schedule 40 PVC. But on the market, DRAM's still the best one out there. The nozzles last forever, but that wand, like you say, right where it hooks onto the hose, it just oxidizes, and after 2 years. But be aware that you can probably, of course, you don't have as much selection, but go to the Friendly Natives or whatever up there, and you can usually buy the wand separately from the nozzle, and consequently you're not having to spend quite as much money every 2 years. But no, I've and believe me, we got about 10 of them on hoses around the nursery, and we experience putting on one or two new ones every month as they give up. But I haven't found anything better, and I'm afraid if there was, it would be prohibitive in price.
Right. Yeah, I just thought I'd check with you. So one last tip. So we use the rock phosphate pretty much on everything we plant.
Okay.
And I don't know. You said it helps a lot on tomatoes, but you didn't see so much benefit on other plants, I guess.
Well, proportionately. On tomatoes, you see a very dramatic effect. On other things, I mean, the rock phosphate, powder rock phosphate, is going to help with rooting on every plant. There are just a few plants that it just seems almost magical for. And tomatoes, you see a profound result with it. Other things, you see some improvement, would be the best way I can state it.
Yeah, okay. So what we do, we take a spice jar that has the shaker top with the little plastic perforated top. You fill that up, and then you take your plant out, and you just open that, and you just shake it all over the root ball.
Yeah, that's what a lot of landscapers do with planting even shrubs and trees. With the tomatoes, I feel like I like having actually, you know, a quarter, half-inch thick layer of it, because that shaking over the roots is going to really help for the first 6 weeks of growth and production. But I count on my tomatoes to produce for a lot longer period of time, and I think you'd have a longer-lasting effect. Of course, your Fredericksburg soils are different from my Bernie soils, but I feel like I get a longer beneficial effect by actually having a layer of it. They have to grow their roots through, and they can continue to benefit from it. But whatever works. Whatever's doing well in your garden, don't change just because I do it a little differently. But sometimes you might try my ideas, and if they're an improvement, then keep on doing them. If not, do whatever you've always done.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We're feeding a whole lot of animals bird seed at night at the feeders, that since there's still no acorns.
Boy, isn't that the truth? I don't mind some of the nocturnal creatures, but you can have the hogs and a few other things that show up to dine on it too. But well, it's good to talk to you. You guys have a good day, and we'll look forward to our next visit. Thank you so much.
Yeah. All right. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. All right, quick break here, and then we're going to talk to Thomas and Cosette and David.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, let's get back to gardening here, and I believe Thomas is up next. Good morning, Thomas.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, sir.
Thanks for being there.
Oh, it's my pleasure. My pleasure.
Yeah. Well, I'm planting a bunch of 4-inch pots, you know, different things.
Okay.
Whenever you put the seed down in there, and you know you water it in real good, how wet do you keep that pot? You know.
Well, it's the thing that's sometimes difficult is being able to water it effectively without washing the soil and the seed out, and that's why I usually use a little mist nozzle, which you have to hold there for some time. But if you're really saturating the soil thoroughly, just wait until that soil feels dry to the touch on top, and, you know, you hit it again really thoroughly. Just be sure that you're not just watering the surface. You want to water all the way through the pot. On average, that's going to be every couple of days. Of course, once the seed sprouts and gets some roots down, it's going to be drying out a whole lot faster. But I just lay my index finger on the surface of the soil. If it feels dry, starts to feel at all powdery, I know it's time to water again. And I'll, you know, turn on that mist nozzle and hold it there for a minute or two till everything's well saturated.
Yeah, I was afraid I might be keeping it too wet, you know, but I understand that. That's about what I've been doing. Just I watch it real close.
Yeah, it would be hard. As you've heard me say so many times, water doesn't hurt anything. But if you keep something so wet, the water drives the oxygen out of the soil. It's the lack of oxygen that does the damage to the plants. And if you're using a good, you know, loose soil mix, as I usually germinate seeds in, I'm not going to say you couldn't keep it too wet, but it's doubtful.
Okay. Another thing, I got about three questions here for you.
Okay.
On the sweet potatoes, how late can you plant the sweet potatoes?
You can plant, you know, on up into the summer. Sweet potatoes are like the white potatoes. They don't truly ripen. The earlier you plant them, the bigger they have time to get before they freeze back in the fall. So I'd say try to have them planted by the middle of July, but you're not in a rush to get them in because there's, in my opinion, there's not a lot of difference in a sweet potato that weighs half a pound and one that weighs 2 pounds. In fact, I'd rather have a little bit smaller sweet potatoes to begin with. So you've got another 6 weeks of good planting time. In fact, more than that, you've got probably another 2.5 months of time that you could plant them. The sooner you get them in, of course, the sooner you will have sweet potatoes to harvest.
Yeah.
But they don't ripen. They don't have to be picked on a given day to get them at the peak of flavor because they taste just about the same as small sweet potatoes as they do big ones.
Well, I haven't been able to find any slips. You know, this one garden, nursery said, well, we didn't get any this year because last year we threw away too many of them. And
yeah, yeah.
So
well, you can always start your own, of course, but that there are some places on the internet that, of course, will send them to you, and you can get a wider range of varieties that way. But lots of folks still just do the old toothpicks in a jar of water and start their own slips from a potato they get at Whole Foods or somewhere.
Right. Another thing I want to ask you about, whenever, like for mosquito control, if you put these mosquito dunks in water, and then strain it off and then use that water in the spray. Would that do any good?
Not really, because the bacteria, the Bacillus thuringiensis israeliensis that's in the mosquito dunk only kills the larval state of the mosquito. And so it's not going to do a whole lot just spraying it around the landscape in dry weather like we typically have here. Maybe in Houston, maybe somewhere that typically gets heavier rainfall, maybe in Panama. I just was reading a book about the Panama Canal. Somewhere like that, it might be effective, but I don't think you would really accomplish much with your liquid solution. Now, one of these days, if we're able to get BTI in a concentrated liquid form, then it might be worth trying. But using little mosquito bits or mosquito dunks, I think you'd be doing a lot of work without much results, especially keeping in mind that mosquitoes can fly up to a mile. You can kill every mosquito in your yard, and you'll still have some of them come in. So I'm going to spray with something like orange oil or spray with garlic if I'm going to have a group over or something. If it's just going to be me, I'm going to light one of the anaeroba candles, and those do a pretty good job of keeping them away. I think you'd be doing a lot of work without much results.
Okay, yeah, well, I haven't done it yet. I thought it works in the water.
Yep. So. Well, it's again, it doesn't do anything to the adult mosquito. It just gets their larvae, so that's why we just use them in the water.
Right, I understand that. You know, I've got a pear tree I bought from Fenix about 3 or 4 years ago.
Uh-huh.
It's doing real good, but this last freeze, when this thing come out, this crazy thing on the base of the tree and the bottom part of it, it's got these shoots that come out, and they're growing right along the bark of the tree straight up.
Uh-huh.
Not out, but just straight up along the trunk.
I've seen them actually try to grow underneath the bark, but those shoots are probably coming off the rootstock, and you don't want to let them get started. Just break them off or cut them off whenever you see them.
Well, that's what I've been, been doing. I just cut them off, but I never saw that before,
pear trees are, I mean, they will produce limbs that just grow totally vertical, and it's just something in those cells, it's called geotrophism, that makes them decide which way to grow, and it is much more pronounced in pears than it is in most other fruit trees. So it's unusual, and this severe cold we had has caused some plants to do some things that I can't explain. I just look at it, shake my head, and move on to something else that I have a better idea of what's going on. But you just keep cutting them off, and hopefully that pear tree will be producing for you pretty soon.
I understand. Okay, Bob. Well, thanks for your time.
Always a pleasure, Thomas. Thank you. And we say good morning to Cosette. Good morning, Cosette.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. How are you today?
Well, I have a problem. So my Basham Party Pinks are about 30 feet tall. They're gorgeous. Uh-huh. The main reason I bought my house, to be honest. But I guess their growing habit is the trunks tend to split, almost like it's a conjoined plant. Is that right?
Oh, I don't really know a word that describes that habit, but I guess that would be as good a word as any, but they do tend to form very narrow angle growth is just the way I've always expressed it. But yeah, know exactly what you're speaking of.
Okay, so I've got leaves on them, but the right side of one of them has no leaves. It looks completely dead, but the left side has leaves. So I've been putting some Medina on it. I've been watering it thoroughly, and I'm still not seeing any leaves. So I don't know, how do I cut off the dead side, because they're conjoined? So I'm not really sure.
I'd give it a while longer to come out. But I wouldn't give up on it leafing out till the 4th of July. If anything, you could, if you were able, because like you say, they do get 30 feet tall. But if you could cut maybe a third off of the limbs, just off the tip of the limbs that are coming out on that side, many times it will force that limb to come out if it's just slow to break dormancy for whatever reason. Are the root flares on these well exposed? Do you see a big broad base where they come up out of the ground?
Yes, I make sure that I keep them exposed. I don't let soil or leaves or anything accumulate over it.
The thing, whenever I
from you early on.
Well, and you're doing a good thing. When I see a plant, whether it's a tree or a big bush like a crepe myrtle or anything like that, and one side of it is not doing as well as the rest of the plant, sometimes what has happened, in fact, frequently what has happened, and you can't really tell this unless you get an air spade or something and, you know, blow the soil away where you can see 6 inches down the trunk of that tree, down even below the root flare. A lot of times if you have a girdling root, keep in mind that a girdling root doesn't have to circle all the way around the trunk to cause problems. If it is simply pressing up against one side of where those roots really start going down into the ground, it can cause that. It can actually cause one side of a tree to simply not do as well. In the extreme, it can actually cause one side of the tree for the limbs on that side to die. So I would be very careful who you called, but I would think about getting a really good arbor, since these crepe myrtles are as important to you as they are. But you could call my friend David Vaughn, who does consulting and nothing else, or you could call Ed Etter over at Etter Tree Care and consult with them about that. That's about the only thing that I've ever seen that will cause one side, other than girdling, and you know, in a young plant, sometimes sunburn. But a lot of times, if one side of the plant is simply not doing as well as the other side, somewhere 4 to 6 inches down underneath the ground, it's got a big old root just pressing up against the side of the trunk, and that could be what's causing it. I'm not saying it is, but that's the main thing that I see happening, and it's not a do-it-yourself job. Sometimes these roots build up so much pressure that when they're cut, it's kind of like pulling a rubber band really tight and then cutting it. You're going to get popped, and you don't want to get popped with a good chunk of root coming free. But if if I had a crepe myrtle that was that important a part of my landscape, I think I would call a very good arborist and have them come out, probably use an air spade to carefully clear away the dirt from the side of the tree that's not doing well, and see if you don't have a girdling root there that could be removed and could allow that plant to do a whole lot better. It's not absolute that that's what it is, but that to me, because you're a good gardener, you're doing everything else right, and that's the one thing that I would imagine could be responsible for causing that problem.
You know, now that you mention that, so I don't know, it has like a baby plant next to it. So is that how it grows? Like it has these shoots? Because it looks like the three large ones, which I gather are the parent plants, they get these shoots.
And that's normal for crepe myrtles.
Like smaller trees?
Yeah, okay. That's normal for crepe myrtles that might or might not contribute to the problem.
Okay. And also, I know everybody's got three questions for you, but I was wondering, it's a trifecta kind of day, Bob.
That's why I'm sitting here doing this. I love it.
Yes. So I was wondering, I have an Arctic Frost Satsuma, and it's in my front yard facing west. I had put mulch down, but not right up against the trunk.
Okay.
So I'm kind of confused about my mulch. I didn't know if I was supposed to water the mulch as well, because I know I don't want to water just around the base of the plant, right? To encourage
sure.
the roots to spread out.
Right.
So how do I place everything as far as adding soil, adding black cow, and then the mulch, like where is the placement on that?
Well,
like,
let's think about what mulch does. Mulch cools the surface of the soil, which really helps the roots. So it doesn't really matter whether it's wet or dry. Mulch suppresses the growth of weeds, so it doesn't really have any effect whether it's wet or dry. It does help through shading and through keeping the soil cooler. It does help retain moisture in the soil. So periodically, water the whole area. I mean, set your sprinkler out in that area or whatever. Water the mulch, but water the surrounding soil as well, because 20% of what the mulch does probably has something to do with moisture. The other 80% really doesn't, have a lot to do with moisture. What it does as far as shading is reducing the evaporation of water, things like that. It doesn't really matter whether the mulch is wet or dry, and it's going to hold some moisture naturally, so I wouldn't be too terribly concerned. I just do a general watering of the area and just don't have your mulch right up against the trunk of the tree or shrub or whatever, but it's doing its work covering the root zone or covering the area where the plant has roots, and this Arctic Frost probably hadn't grown roots too far out. So what you're doing is just shading and cooling the soil in the area where the roots are. So obviously a big plant, it would be nice to mulch a little further out than is necessary with a small plant, but it's not an exact science.
Okay, so if I believe the diameter of my trunk is probably close to 2 inches.
Okay. I'd try to have your mulch maybe out 4 feet from the tree. If you take the diameter of the trunk, double that and convert it to feet instead of inches. I mean, if it was a 1-inch trunk, I'd, probably go 2 feet out. 2-inch trunk, I'd probably go 4 feet out. 3-inch trunk, I would, you get to a point where you can't just cover the whole yard, but a young tree, I like to say double the diameter and convert that to feet, just call those feet, and that's about how far out I'd have the mulch.
Oh, okay. Well, I could totally remember that. And also, can I transplant a rosemary plant? It's not very large. It likes where it's at. However, my mother decided to plant, she lives on our property, and she decided to plant a passion flower vine, and it is clinging all over that thing.
Okay. How long has the rosemary been in the ground?
I would say since last spring.
Okay. You could transplant it. I wish we'd done it back when the weather was cooler, because we're moving into the hot time of the year, and that's when it's hard to transplant woody plants. But if the plant's, you know, not going to make it where it is. You've got nothing to lose. But if you think it could stay there a while longer, I would put it off and do it next fall after the weather cools off.
Okay, and then what's the best place to plant it?
Full sun, soil that drains well, where nobody's going to plant a passion vine.
Okay, awesome. Thanks so much, Bob. You enjoy the rest of your weekend.
You certainly do, too, because it's good to talk to you. Thank you. Bye. All right, got to get a break in here, and David and Steve are my next two callers after that. I get to talk to you about Rhonda and Rhonda's Nature's Way. What a pleasure that is. Talk about a lady who has improved the lives of so many people through teaching them about good health, about the benefit of natural supplements, and who offers these products so much better than you're going to find on a grocery store shelf or a chain pharmacy. Plus, she and her staff have the knowledge to really, really help. You're going to a nutritionist, you're going to a naturopath, you're going to somebody that really understands how the human body works. And Rhonda's Nature's Way offers the very best in products and services. They do the red light, beamer light therapy. I tell you, your doctor will tell you how good those are. She does reflexology at the Northside store. They do a detox foot bath. They do some wonderful things for your ears. So just a lot of things that will make you feel better and will give you relief from problems like digestive issues or sleep issues or pain issues. There's some wonderful things that Rhonda provides. And right now, she is always, you know, looking for other people that would like to learn more. She needs some help, basically, at both of her stores. And if you have an interest in learning a great deal about that and earning some money, it's mainly part-time work. But let me tell you, if you're good, I'm sure it could grow into a full-time position. Next time you're in Rhonda's Nature's Way, ask her about that if you're interested. And if you don't know about Rhonda's Nature's Way, if you feel like you could feel better, look better, feel a little healthier, you just need to get to know the good people at Rhonda's Nature's Way. They're closed today and every Sunday. Other 6 days, you're going to find them. The Southside stores over on Southwest Military. Northside stores in the shopping center there at the corner of I-10 and Callahan. They would love to see you, and you would love to visit Rhonda's Nature's Way.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right, back to gardening on a nice Sunday morning out there. And, so many things to talk about. So many people interested in talking about them. It's going to be, let's see here, get this in right in order. David and Steve and Terry and Joyce. And David is up first. Good morning, David.
Hey, Bob, thank you so much for taking my call.
One of those Thanks for calling.
Is you just, you, I keep on thinking up more questions to ask you. Anyway, first off, I've got this driveway. Oh, gosh, it's just endless driveway, crosses the dry creek and the whole thing. But the every spring as stuff grows in, and I've thinned it, and I'm less inclined to cut anything down at this point. And so I want to cable all the, pull these things back. And is there anything about, like, running a, a lag screw or, an eye bolt into a side of a tree? Does that, doesn't do any particular damage to the tree?
Not really. If somebody's ever trying to cut that tree up with a chainsaw, they're going to be very unhappy with whoever did that. If I were doing it on an oak tree, either a red oak or a live oak, I would screw it in, and then I would spray that area with pruning paint, just because anytime you create a wound, in fact, the place that they think oak wilt started up in Illinois, where lots of our problems seem to start, they think it was actually started somebody putting up a basketball goal. How on earth they tracked it down like that, but that's from the first oak wilt conference I think ever held that I went too many years ago. So I wouldn't really worry about it. It's far better to put a ring bolt, or something like that in, than it would be to wrap a cable around it, which could, of course, cause a number of girdling problems. So I wouldn't hesitate. And if it's on a hackberry or an elm or something like that, no need to do anything, or a pecan. But on either live oak or red oak, I would, just after you put the bolt in, I'd spray that area right around it with some pruning paint or any other good sealing type of paint.
Okay. I was listening to that fellow from Fredericksburg with the oak wilt problems, and I'm in drift. I've had oak wilt come through here years ago and, took out a lot of stuff, left some trees. I've also noticed, though, this year that there's some big trees, healthy last year, that are just, they're not coming out. Is that necessarily oak wilt, or can that be just a you know, they're just done. They're, you know,
that well, that can just be drought.
You know, yeah,
there's, we are very, very, very dry. And again, when we have this kind of drought, and a lot of areas, this is bad or worse in 2011. That was our worst one-year drought on record. Oak wilt problems will be made worse by this kind of drought. So put an extra dollar in the collection plate and pray for a little more rain or whatever. But
I do it every day.
Isn't that the truth? The one other thing I'll tell you, if you're going to hold vegetation back with a, you know, whether it's a nylon rope or a cable or whatever you do, if you're pulling back any woody vegetation that you really want to protect, take an old piece of garden hose or something like that and run the cable through that rather than have it rubbing directly on the bark. If it's anything you want to protect, that will really reduce damage because, you know, the wind's going to come up, that stuff's going to move around and rub back and forth. But other than that, nothing at all wrong with your plan.
Yeah. All right. Well, so one of the plants that really just went crazy this year is the wisteria, and it's growing up. I got it growing up into, I mean, it's 20 feet up into the trees. Is there any problem with letting that? Like, I've got a you know, live oak right by the house, and a bunch of volunteers. They're ready to go. They're And I'm just thinking about just letting that wisteria just go up in there. It was stunning. The flowers were stunning this year.
I'm sure. The only problem, and, you know, I've seen enormous trees. I can't say I've ever seen a wisteria grown quite that well up a tree. But I see trees that are half covered with grapevine that are still doing just fine. Just keep in mind that the leaves of the wisteria are going to be competing with the leaves of the oak tree for light. So anytime that wisteria is so thick that is not letting the light get through to the leaves of the oak tree, that particular branch is not going to do as well. In fact, you know, that's why the interior branches die on a tree, is just simply that the outer branches shade the interior branches so much. So that could be an issue 10 years down the road, but I'm not going to lose any sleep over it.
I'm not either. Okay, yeah. One last quick question. There's a night bird. I always thought it was a whippoorwill, and then some neighbor said, that's not a whippoorwill. They're like, I mean, this thing, they go all night long.
Is there
another night bird that I'm...
There's a very similar bird called a poorwill that has a slightly different note. It has sort of a two-note song rather than a, you know, a more extended one. But, there are two of them that do a lot of calling at night that way. Plus, there are a number of night birds that will make occasional sounds. But if it's one that's just sitting out there trying to keep you awake, you know, the whippoorwill makes that whippoorwill sound. The other is more of a two-tone, and that's probably what they call a poorwill.
That's what that is. I'm going outside and just because, once you focus on it, it drives you crazy.
Well, you don't have to admit that you've gone outside with a shotgun, but I know some people are almost to that point.
Perfect, man. Thank you so much. I always listen to the show. I think of questions during the week. I wonder what Bob Webster would think about this.
Well, it's always a pleasure to talk to you and compare notes, so to speak, when we're talking about bird calls. So you get out and have a great Sunday, and I know we'll talk again. Next in line is Steve. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Bob. How are you doing?
Off to a good start.
I have a question. My front yard was inundated with weeds. It's a Bermuda. So over the winter, I spray with orange oil vinegar, did that three applications. I still had a lot of weeds, pulled them all out. Now I have a lot of bare areas. What do you recommend, just letting the other Bermuda go in place, or reseeding with seeds and just watering them in?
You know, if
I have, or probably 1 to maybe 2 feet, and then maybe 3 to 4 feet at the most.
Well, that's, you've just answered my question. I would water and fertilize. I wouldn't just, you know, and count on the Bermuda to do it without any support. But we're just coming into the time of year when Bermuda really grows. I've seen Bermuda grow 6 inches a day. So I would very definitely make a good application of organic fertilizer. I would be watering at least once a week. I'd be putting down an inch of water. And under those circumstances, the Bermuda should fill in those areas with much less effort than trying to put down seed. Unless you were doing just a big blank pallet, I would never recommend Bermuda seed. Actually, I would tell you, if any of these spots you wanted to fill in a little bit faster, just go to a part of your yard where you've got really thick Bermuda, dig up a little 3-inch square piece of it, or okay. You know, section of it, and go just gouge out a little spot in the ground, throw it down and stomp on it, and maybe give that even a little bit of extra water. But those spots, with some help from you in the form of water and fertilizer, should fill in very, very quickly as we get into summer.
Yeah, I fertilized about a month ago with the Growing Green, and I put an application of liquid molasses and the Medina soil, what is it?
Soil activator.
Soil activator.
It sounds like all you need to do is water. And if you want to transplant a couple little squares over there, that'll just make it happen that much faster.
Okay. Anything I can do to get rid of the weeds besides manually pulling them out that you recommend?
Well, your mower is your very best weed control thing we have. And Bermuda, as long as it's getting plenty of sun, Bermuda will choke out most weeds. It's just, you know, a lawn is just a battle between, you know, what's going to dominate, what's going to be the thickest, strongest growing plant out there. And Bermuda is stronger than 99% of the weeds. A straggler daisy might be a little bit of an issue, but if you get your Bermuda thick enough, it's going to choke out any other thing that might be a problem to you. So don't break your back out there trying to pull. Just keep it mowed. Keep it, fertilize it like every 3 months, give it a good thorough drink once a week, and if you can manage to keep that up, you should have an absolutely gorgeous lawn.
All right. I appreciate it, Bob. Listen to you always, so good luck, and thank you.
Well, it's always a pleasure, Steve. I appreciate the call. Thank you. Let's just take one more call here before we have to do a commercial, and that would be Terry. Good morning, Terry.
Hey, Bob. I have a project you can help me with. I live about 3 miles east of Pipe Creek on a hill.
Okay.
And I have mostly rock. You go down about a foot and you get crumbling limestone.
Uh-huh.
So I'm going to terrace out about 30 feet and build up the soil so I can plant fruit trees.
Okay.
But the first step is getting rid of the Texas mountain laurel and a horrible bush that has razor sharp leaves and yellow sap. I don't know what it's called.
Well, it's probably agarita. The leaves are not so razor sharp, but they've got prickles by the jillions, and they bloom yellow in the spring and then have kind of a purplish berry. And it's actually, I'm trying to remember the technical name of the group that it's in. But, yeah, the common name of it is agarita. And you better be wearing chainmail armor if you're going to be going through that. Both of those things, they are woody plants, so there's not a lot you could pour on them that would kill them without doing some damage to the soil. I simply, when I want to eliminate it, I first of all take my heavy-duty long-handled pruners, cut it back to where it's about 6 inches tall, and then get in there with a grubbing hoe and just, you know, chop around the base, cut the roots. Mountain laurel, you'll eliminate quickly that way. It will not come back. Agarita, you may have to do it a time or two, but that's in an area that I want to grow things. That's certainly how I would go about getting it under control.
With a grubbing hoe?
A grubbing hoe, you know what a pickaxe is?
Yeah.
Okay. If you took a pickaxe and you took the one side of it and broadened it out to where it was about 2 to 3 inches wide, and, mm-hmm. you know, just a not a cutting sharp blade, but a blade on that back. That's a grubbing hoe. Now, the front end can either be a straight spike or it can be, you know, the same thing just turned vertically. But a grubbing hoe is something that whoever your strong helper is will use to just chop down. Yeah, then in that case, don't overdo it, but you'll get some good exercise. But it's the most useful thing in the world. And what you're doing is just cutting things off an inch or two below the surface of the ground and pulling them out.
So if I get an inch or two below the ground, which means I've got layers and layers of rock, it's taken me about a day to get through all the rock to get about an inch down.
Oh, just do it at ground level. Just do it at ground level. You're going to kill the mountain laurel easily. The agarita, you just, you know, chop it off right at the ground. And then if it sprouts out, do this two or three times and it will die.
Okay, well, that's what I've been cutting it down at ground level, and it comes right back. I mean, it's just like the. I wish my tomatoes grew that way.
Well,
What
you just have to do is you just have to keep it from making very much foliage, because as soon as it starts making many, many leaves, then it's building sugar so that it can keep coming back. Just if you have to do it on a weekly basis, just get out there and take off everything that comes out. If you want to mix up a little vinegar and orange oil and spray that foliage, that will also help. If you're planning to cover it up, you could always, you know, cut it off at ground level and then put some sort of barrier on top of it. And I'm talking about something like just an old roofing shingle or something like that down right directly over the base of that plant, and then come back with your soil, and not one out of ten is going to grow through that. Now, to get a deep enough area there that you can plant other things, we'd be talking huge amounts of soil if you're actually going to terrace the area. But what I would think about doing is probably creating, and you can kind of, you know, go along and create it along the contour of the property, but make a little individual raised area that's maybe 3 feet by 4 feet or something like that, which is going to give you enough room to at least get a tree started in. But we're talking truckloads of dirt to actually terrace it and build it up deep enough, because these, you know, fruit trees and things, they want to have 18 to 24 inches of soil to really thrive. So we're talking about creating a pretty significant little area there. I'm not suggesting it because I can't think of anything that would look more, I don't even know what the appropriate politically correct term would be, but let's just say I had a cousin who was not concerned about the visual appearance of things. And what Bubba did, appropriately named, is he would take about four old tires and stack them one on top of the other, fill that with soil, and that's where he planted his fruit trees. And he had a beautiful orchard, but I'm sure in town code compliance would have had a few things to say about the appearance. But my point is, it doesn't have to look great, but you do need to be able to create an area with pretty deep soil if you're going to hope to grow any kind of fruit tree well.
Right.
Smaller plants need less soil, but you're going to have a pretty good little bit of soil there one way or another to grow peaches or plums or pears or figs or whatever it is you have in mind.
Well, this will bring it up about 3 feet at the extreme.
Well, that would be good. That would be excellent. It's going to take a substantial little retaining, I'll call it a retaining wall, even if it's just stacked rock. But you're going to get
rock.
Yeah. Well, you're going to have some pressure behind it. So you might look, there's an old fellow who's still around, as far as I know, but who did this and actually wrote a book about it named David Bamberger. And his ranch is called Selah, and it's up more toward the Austin area. But he took a rough old piece of ground and turned it into an absolutely beautiful area and somehow enticed Boy Scouts and many others to come back and pick up rocks and create this terracing effect, although I don't think he did anything that was 3 feet, you know, up. But you might Google David Bamberger, and there's several books have been written about his big project, and might be just a little interesting reading for you to see what he did and how he did it.
Okay. Well, that is my project, and I know it will take a couple of years, but it's worth it.
Well, you get as much as you can done before it gets super hot. I would strongly suggest, unless you have another favorite product, check out this electrolyte. It's called Ultima, U-L-T-I-M-A. I get mine from Rhonda's Nature's Way, but I know you can also get it at Natural Grocers in some places. It's a little packet. You put that with a glass full of water, and it gives you all the benefits of some of these sports drinks, but without all the sugar, and it tastes darn good. There are about six flavors. Raspberry's my favorite. Lemonade's my second favorite. But I buy that by the box, not by the individual packet, because I sure go through a lot of it in the summer months. And it'll both make you feel better and can really avoid serious problems. There are a lot of people that have that don't pay attention to enough water consumption, and they get sick or worse in the summer. So if you don't have another favorite electrolyte, check out Ultima, because it will help you get through this big project a whole lot better.
I will think about that. May I ask you just one real short question?
Go right ahead, Terry.
Okay. By accident, I started attracting honeybees. I had left some hot honey out, and the raccoons chewed a hole in it. And when I went out, the bees were just so happy about it. So I left it out there and let them feed on it. Mm-hmm. And now I've got honeybees. Does that hurt them to give them honey?
No, that's their natural food source.
Okay.
Food source. Be aware that it is almost impossible to visually, without a microscope, tell the difference between just a regular honeybee and one of these super aggressive ones that's called the Africanized bee. And you will not know the difference. The Africanized bee is not aggressive when it's out eating honey or just foraging. But anytime you got lots of bees, be aware that you could have a colony of them in a hollow in a tree. You could have them, you know, under the siding of a building. Anytime you're seeing a lot of bees, just be aware there's a possibility, especially out in the country, that they could be some of the aggressive ones. And if you do find a colony, find a hive, avoid it. If you have any allergy to these things, sometimes you almost even have to eliminate it, because these things have killed people and pets. So if you're seeing a lot of bees, again, when they're just out feeding, they pose absolutely no threat to you whatsoever. But if you see a bunch of them flying around a hollow in a tree, or going in and out on the siding around an outbuilding or something like that, treat it with extreme caution.
Okay. All right. Well, that helps a whole lot.
So you get out and enjoy this day, and good luck with your project. It sounds like you've got a good one going, Terry.
It is. Okay. Thank you, Bob.
You're welcome. Thank you.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right. Back to gardening. Straight back to the phone lines. It's going to be Joyce and Clint and Frank, and Joyce is first. Good morning, Joyce.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning to you.
You know, the caller before you was talking about bees. I heard an interview the other day that was kind of interesting to me about a guy that has a little company that does bee removal and relocation. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was kind of an interesting situation.
It is, and it's a good thing, the people that do it and do it right. Unfortunately, it can be quite expensive. But, it's a good thing. And sometimes you get some money out of the deal.
Yeah, and they also talked about, which I'd kind of heard about, but not recently, about renting beehives to people who want more bees in location, you know, that have a little bit of acreage. I don't think they do it from just a lot in the city. But anyway, well, that's not what I called about.
But to your point, there are people that do that even in the city. And actually, one of the hotels over on I-10 at one point was establishing some beehives on an upstairs terrace area where people didn't frequent. So a lot of people doing a lot of good things. My friend Dr. Kirby, he keeps bees in his backyard in Alamo Heights.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's no reason why not. Anyway, that isn't what I called about, so let me get going. You have people waiting.
Yeah.
It's a sweet potato question, too, and that is, last year I tried, but I started really late to plant one in a big pot. It was so puny at the end of the year, I didn't even really look for a sweet potato. I just forgot about it and let it go. And now I notice it's coming up. So I guess the potato stayed in the ground. So that's good, but that's still not the point that I was doing. I found a big old sweet potato that I forgot about, and I always buy the organic one because I want to eat the peeling.
Sure.
And so I noticed it has about a half inch to a inch sprout coming out in just one place up at the end of the potato. And when you've talked to people about growing these things, you said that when they grow out, to take a piece of the potato, a gouge out part of the potato, and start it in a 4-inch pot or something to get it going good. Why could I not do, instead of putting it in water and going through all that, why couldn't I just set you the big sweet potato, take out about an inch square hunk of potato and put it in a pot where I could keep and take care of it? Wouldn't that also work?
I don't know that I would go for that big a piece of potato, because the potato is going to decay and fairly rapidly. What I think you could do is simply take a sharp knife, and, you know, just kind of move slightly away from the sprout and just cut down at a slight angle. Do the same thing on the other side, so you've got a little wedge of sweet potato that's maybe an inch and a half long and half an inch wide, and then use that to start, we call them slips, and there would be nothing at all wrong with doing that. If you want to be, you know, 99% sure that it would do, you could actually put it in perlite instead of in soil, and almost be guaranteed that it would root and then transfer to the soil later. You just need to keep that in a real bright spot out on your patio, probably, since you may not have any windows to get that much light.
No,
but
I don't.
Just keep it moist and keep it bright, and you've just started your own slip.
So you can start out with a pretty small eye. I mean, you can tell it's an eye.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have to be grown a big vine. And then he's, okay.
No, well, in fact, it will root much better if it's a small vine rather than a big vine when you do this.
Okay. But even as a little eye, that's a lot, like half an inch with all the little red, you know, you can definitely tell it's an eye.
Well, wait until it has some leaves. Wait until you see some leaves started.
Okay.
And then take your slip. And what a lot of people do is, again, just take three toothpicks and suspend that in a jar of water. And you can get a dozen slips off one potato.
Okay. Well, I was just, I just thought it's going to be easier if I could take it out while it was fairly small.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
And do it rather than going to making roots on the potato, because the root of the potato doesn't really do anything to the slip. You know,
exactly.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Your plan should work fine.
Okay, good. Well, I'll try that. Well, second question and last. And that is Belinda's dream. About a year and a half ago, I succeeded in rooting myself three nice cuttings and got them in 5-inch pots, and each of them has given me one rose this spring.
Good.
So they're ready to go somewhere. But I have so little sun. The best sun I have is in one of those typical 4-foot by long rectangular beds that they do in the neighborhood that are right off the street.
Right.
And my question is, I guess you can grow anything anywhere if you give it what it needs, but is it feasible? Because I know that Belinda's Dream, I've seen yours, it gets to be a big, big bush. Can it be maintained in a 4-foot by, well, the length sidewise?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. What you'll do is just... Belinda's Dream, being an own-root vigorous rose, does not have to be pruned the way some of these modern grafted hybrids do. But there's no reason that you can't give it a pretty severe haircut in February every year and just keep it to a little bit more compact plants. You'll still get plenty of the great, big, beautiful blooms, but you can have a plant that's, you know, 4 feet by 4 feet instead of 8 feet by 8 feet, and it'll be just as healthy and just as vigorous and a whole lot less dangerous to anybody who walks by it too closely.
Yeah, well, that was the point, because they do, a lot of people walk, but that bed is at least 4 or more feet wide. So
that's plenty of room for it, Joyce.
Okay. Well, that'll work well. Well, good luck to you and all of your little fuzzy family. I hope all are doing well, and we'll...
Well, we had a real close call with one of the girls, but I happen to know this absolutely incredible veterinarian who pulled her through, and so everybody is doing very well now, thank you.
Oh, goodness gracious, that must have been a scare to you. Well, I'm glad things are doing well, so good.
It's called idiopathic autoimmune hemolytic anemia, and it's not something you want to mess with, but an absolutely wonderful friend. She's back up to totally normal blood levels and hopefully going to be going for quite a while longer, so thanks for asking.
Well, I'm glad. I may have to call Dr. Kirby later, too, because I have a question about my neighbor's puppy dog that I was wondering about some things. So I may do that if I can get through. So we'll see. Well, thank you, Bob.
You're welcome, Joyce. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right. It's going to be Clint and Frank and Glenn and Beverly. Clint is first. Good morning, Clint.
Good morning, Bob. How you doing?
It's just a beautiful Sunday out there.
I hear that. Listening to y'all popped up two more questions. I didn't even think about calling to ask. Y'all were talking about bees. I got a hollow in the tree in the backyard. I'm on the fence. I really don't want to destroy them.
Uh-huh.
And every wall, beehive over the years, have always commenced putting a whooping on me at the wrong point in time. And,
right.
And I don't know if they were the African ones or just mean wild bees, but I was thinking, any chance of a smoker will calm them down so I can cut the grass and all that other stuff?
Man, I just hate to trust them. My advice would probably be either do it really early in the morning when it's still cool, when the bees haven't gotten real active. But these, you know, the Africanized bees are just, they're deadly. I mean, they do kill people and pets, and anybody that has any kind of allergic reaction to them, it's increasingly dangerous. What I would try to do, and I would do this from a distance, with a butterfly net or something like that, I would try to capture a single bee, and I would take it to probably a pest control company. Because, and I don't know the difference, but I do know that I've done this with ABC here in San Antonio, and taken them a bee and said, hey, is this an Africanized bee? And they stick it under the scope, and they can tell you yes or no, and then you'll know how much of a threat that they pose to you. But you could attempt to smoke them out, but you just don't want to get them riled up. I mean, if you had a professional beekeeper's garb, you know, that big old net hat and thick clothing and things like that, but that's the only way I'm going to get near a beehive that I'm not sure of, because he would mind me telling you this, Dr. Kirby keeps, you know, the good domestic bees in his backyard, but he got stung near the eye recently, and he was a sick man for 2 or 3 days, so it's just not something you really want to mess with, Clint.
I had a bee. I was out working in the garden, and the bee come up out of nowhere. It hit me just under the eye. And
yeah.
I'm looking, and there was a drum in the grass I never knew about.
Uh-huh.
Probably about 80, 90 feet away.
Yep. Yep.
So I'm
well,
gonna
I if you know anybody down in your area, if you know any of the pest control folks, they probably wouldn't even charge you for it. Just tell them, hey, I'm concerned. You know, here's a bee. When you get it, stick it in the freezer or something like that, so you're not, you know, you're not damaging it to where they can't examine it. But stick it in the freezer to keep it from posing a threat, shall we say? And get a good an apiarist or somebody like that really knows bees to take a look. Somebody you can trust and just determine if it's Africanized or not. I sure would feel a lot better about it, because, you know, you're a good guy, and I don't want to see you laid up, because these things, when they come after you, you know, you can get 100 or more stings very, very quickly, and bee venom is very different from wasp venom, and it's just something that can mess you up or kill you, and we don't need to go any further than that. I sure don't want to see that happen to anybody, let alone somebody I really enjoy talking to.
And did you say they can kill dogs all that?
Oh, yeah. Fur? Yeah. There are probably 10 dogs killed for every human that gets badly hurt. But, yeah, the dogs go nosing around, get after the bees, and it's usually has a very bad outcome for the dog.
Good deal. Well, I appreciate the advice on that one. I got a friend I'm trying to get off the chemicals and stuff, and he likes the We Be Gone. And I was telling him about how the pickle rim doesn't go away, and the remedy and all those problems. He was asking, does the We Be Gone, does that hang out, or is that something that got dissipates, or how would
it
you
does,
get that
it
out
does,
of the
oil? It does break down. It is one of those ones that will be totally decomposed over time, and it is a very well-known cancer causer. It's not going to stick around and destroy your soil, but it may give you cancer. So I would strongly discourage. Tell them it's one of the primary ingredients of Ancient Orange. And I have a couple of very good friends, very messed up by Vietnam exposure to Ancient Orange. So maybe that'll get his attention.
His attention, definitely. Now, I was thinking about maybe a bay leaf tree out here. My better half loves cooking bay leaves, and I guess the
bay
leaf tree – has some good tea benefits, but I don't know if you really use that much. But then I also heard they kind of grow wild in this area. Is that
Oh, yeah. That? Yeah. As long as you'll give them a little moisture when it gets really dry, bay is extremely easy to grow. And it has lots of different uses. You know, you can crumble up those leaves. If you're saving cornmeal or anything like that, you can put it in flour, cornmeal, things like that. You won't ever have weevils get into it. You could probably have a good restaurateur friend who's really good, and he loves it when I'll take him a few branches off my big bay tree, and he does like a little garnish, a little decorative thing around each plate in his restaurant. So it's almost impossible to have too much bay, and I'm an old horse trader. It's amazing what a bag of ripe tomatoes or some good bay leaf will get you in the way of a free drink or a free hamburger or whatever might be out there. So, no, I'd strongly encourage you to plant a bay tree.
Now, do you harvest old growth or new growth, or it doesn't really matter?
Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. I like to let it go until it's a little leathery just because it lasts longer and it's easier to crumble. But it's going to be quite aromatic. The leaves develop that aroma pretty quickly, and if your lady friend does any Cajun cooking, you will definitely benefit from having a bay tree around.
Oh, no lady friends. I just have a better half of the last 33 years.
You know, well, I guess if you were going to get in trouble, it would have happened a long time before now. But hopefully you and I are the only one in 50,000 other people hearing this conversation, or you just might be in trouble.
Oh no, she loves listening to you too.
Very good, Glenn. I appreciate it. You be careful with those bees and get out there and have a great Sunday.
You too. Take care.
Thank you so much. Goodbye. All right, let me pause for a second here and talk about another great guy, and that's my friend Dr. Mark Williamson. You know, dental health just has a lot to do with your overall health, and you just want to stay in the best of dental health, and that requires having a good dentist. That requires having somebody that you feel comfortable with, somebody that treats you properly, and I think should be somebody that treats you like a friend, like a trusted comrade, not somebody who just sees you as a dollar sign, trying to move as many as you and as many people like you through his practice as quickly as he can. And that's what modern corporate dentistry has turned into. It's just a factory operation. Well, if you would like to get back to quality dentistry, kind of the old-fashioned way, you need to know about Dr. Mark Williamson. He's one of the most skilled dentists and oral surgeons of anybody I know. There are very, very few problems that Dr. Williamson can't take care of right there in his office. He's not going to be sending you to a specialist for everything that's a little beyond cleaning and maybe filling a cavity or whatever. Dr. Williamson tackles the tough oral medicine problems and does it in a very friendly, very stress-free fashion. You know, he's carried on a lot of what Dr. Staffel started with sedation dentistry for people who are really bothered by it. But just the minute you walk into his office, it just feels different. You've got a very welcoming atmosphere. You've got one of the most skilled dentists in the world. You've got a staff that sincerely cares about you. And when you can combine quality dentistry with just a really comfortable environment, I don't know what you would be looking for any more for. Dr. Williamson has years and years of experience, and is just, like I say, he's very well qualified and also an extremely capable man who has created a true family practice. Why don't you find out what I'm talking about? If it's time for a new dentist, or if you're new to the area and you're looking for a really good dentist, well, check out Dr. Williamson and Associates. Your number's 341-2569, 210 area code, of course, 341-2569 for Dr. Williamson and Associates.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster, News Talk 550, KTSA, and FM 107.1.
All right. Oh, golly, I can't help but hear ads like that last one. And since it's not a local one, I will point out to you that a lot of these things that are made to attract mosquitoes or whatever kind of bugs, very, very hard on the populations of beneficial insects that fly at night, like lacewings and things like that. So be very careful where you would put anything like that up, and keep in mind that we do have some really good guys out there like lacewings that do a lot of things when it comes to pest control. Let's get back to the phone lines. Frank, Glenn, Beverly, and Sarah. And Frank is up first. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, sir.
How's everybody in San Antonio?
Well, I can't speak for the entire city, but everybody in my immediate vicinity, including two black dogs and two orange cats, we all seem to be doing well.
Good, good. I was down there at your place last weekend and met Wendy, and very helpful people you have working over there.
Oh, we've got an incredible staff. We've got people that love people, and it makes all the difference. So sure appreciate you visiting us. Sorry I didn't get to see you.
No, that's cool. I knew you had a rebroadcast of your show and everything. We were just trying to get back to Washington County before it rained.
Well, I will admit we were celebrating my business partner's birthday, and we were headed for the coast at that time. So it was no apologies. I'm here about 50 weeks out of the year, and it was a great couple of days we were able to get away. So I'm glad our staff took good care of you. But how can I help you today?
Well, I was just wondering. I was kind of worried about Clint. You know, if anybody knows him, they need to go check on him this afternoon, because I think he may be in trouble.
I think he's open to suggestion, and I hope we made the point clear to not just him, but the other 50,000 or people. Those, you know, bees. The one thing is, I just hate it when people just want to go kill every bee they see because they're worried about it. Because even the Africanized bees are perfectly harmless. I mean, if you grab them, sure, they'll sting you, but they're not going to attack you when they're out foraging in the garden or anything like that. It's when something threatens their colony that they can become deadly. So I, you know, like you know me, I just want to give 10 times more information than people ask for, just to be sure everybody understands.
That's why we love your program.
I appreciate that.
But I was more worried about him and his wife.
Well, what did he mention? 20-some-odd years, you know, if they haven't been at each other's throat by now, they're probably got it worked out pretty well. But people who can joke about things tend to have very healthy relationships, thank goodness. I suspect it's I'm going to quote my engineer and something he said recently that I just think this is one of the most profound things that I've ever heard. But we were talking about the fact that you can tell with guys, you can tell how much they like each other by the insults that they throw at each other. I mean, you see somebody and you start picking on them immediately, you know they're really good friends. Well, Chris said this is the difference in men and women, that when men get together, they pretend they hate each other, but they really love each other. When women get together, they pretend to love each other, but they really hate each other. I just thought, and of course that's poking fun at being very insincere about it, but anyway, sure made me laugh, and I hope it does you too.
You bet. And you understand that as well as other guys out there. We get it.
All right. But well, we've had women in our lives for a lot of years.
We drifted off from gardening so quickly, and it's my fault.
Well, and let's get back to gardening and how I can help you.
All right, I've got a big rose bed. It's about 15 by 30, and I've been working on this thing for about 22 years now.
Okay.
And I've still got grass coming up through there, and I've got cardboard that is my base, you know, and I've had to replace that a couple of times, of course. But is there a mulch that's more resistant to weeds and grass than any other mulch? And I know it's the thickness of the layer of the mulch that you put out there.
Well, that's a great question, and you have to consider a little bit about what kind of weeds we're talking about. We have weeds that grow when a seed blows in and, you know, germinates and grows, and typically a very coarse mulch is going to have a lot less problem with the seed blowing in and sprouting and growing than a very fine mulch. So if that's the type of weed we're talking about, yes, there would be a big difference in mulches, and the coarser the mulch is, the less weeds you're going to have sprouting come up in it. On the other hand, if we're talking about a weed that is already in the ground and comes up through the mulch, like Bermuda grass, I've had Bermuda grass come up through 2 feet of good mulch. And so that kind of thing, no, I don't know that there is any any mulch, and of course technically black plastic is a mulch, but if you're dealing with something like Bermuda grass coming up, no, you've got to solarize it, you've got to do whatever you can to kill it. But if it's the henbit, the dandelions, the crabgrass, the winter grasses that blow in, the thicker and more coarse the mulch is, the fewer of those seeds you will have sprout and grow.
Well, I've got all of the above. I mean, I've got Johnson grass poking through there, and that's coming up from way down deep. I know that.
Yeah. But,
it just gets to a point because it's in a area that I can't, you know, it's in a driveway. And
Sure. Johnson grass is one of the easiest things to kill, because if you can keep it from growing a big top, if you just mow Johnson grass, you know, religiously for a couple of months, it'll die out because it has to make a tall top. In this area, if you would just spray it down with orange oil every time it comes up, given a little time, you will totally eliminate the Johnson grass. But Bermuda grass is another story. You can kill that stuff 100 times and it always seems to come back. But, at some point, if you can, solarize it. Cover it up with plastic, either black or clear, and leave it that way for six weeks in the hot summer. And that's the best way I've found to go after it.
I have part of that already with some black plastic with some bricks covering it up, but I know this isn't the right time of year to do that,
right,
to get it thoroughly. But one more thing. I think it was on a Saturday morning about a month ago or so, you were talking about, like, when an acorn falls in a trunk,
uh-huh,
say if there's a trunk of a dead tree laying, and you
uh-huh
called it something, and I can't remember what that was.
I don't know the specific term for it, but there are some trees, the big redwoods and things like that, and some of the Douglas firs and things that you see, and I saw this most pronounced up on the Puget Sound area, but those, they have to germinate and grow above the ground. They absolutely have to have that root flare really well exposed. So if their seed lands on the ground, it usually doesn't grow. It lands on top of what they call a nurse log. Maybe that's the term you were thinking of.
They call it
a nurse log, and it grows its roots down, and gradually the log rots away, and that's why you walk out and sometimes see these trees that look like they, you know, they've got 4 feet of root before they even go into the ground. That's why, because the log that they started on is totally rotted away.
Okay, I knew you'd come up with it, but always love your program, and just let's pray for Clint.
Along with the rain. Frank, you get out and have a wonderful Sunday. We're almost up to news time here. Glenn, you'll be up next, and then Beverly and Sarah.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right, back to gardening. Can't believe we've already talked gardening for 2 hours, launching into last hour of gardening, and then we'll have an hour of pets with Dr. Kirby. Looks like it's going to be Glenn and Beverly and Sarah and Gary, and that would mean Glenn's up first. Good morning, Glenn.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Two simple questions. My multiplying onions are starting to flower. Is it worthwhile to try and collect those seeds and reuse them?
That's strictly up to you. Multiplying onions are normally propagated by just dividing the clumps of onions, but there's no reason you can't collect the seed and plant it. It takes a while for them to get up and make, you know, a fair-sized little onion, but like I say, I'd say 90% of the time they're propagated just by dividing the original clump. And when you're dividing the original clump, you know you're getting exactly the same genetics. So every plant is going to be what you want, because onions may possibly be insect pollinated. If you've got other onions growing and flowering in the area, you could get some oddball stuff come out of growing it from seed. So try it if you like, but your main focus should probably be on dividing the clumps that you're producing.
Well, my multiplying onions are about a 15-foot long bed right now, and I keep multiplying them.
It's hard to have too many of them. It's hard to have too many good onions.
That's true. Second question. I saw someplace that if you planted a tomato plant sideways, you get a bigger and better root system.
Well, yes and no. Tomatoes are one of the few plants in the world that can actually sprout roots all the way up and down the trunk. And a way of planting an overgrown tomato, and I learned this a lot of years ago, a gentleman I worked with up in the hill country, we had some commercial growers that would come in and they would always want our biggest, most overgrown plants. And I said, how on earth are you going to plant these things? And he said, oh, we're just going to dig a trench and plant them sideways like you're talking about. And they grew very good plants. On the other hand, I don't know that that makes a better plant than just, you know, getting a good transplant and planting a little bit deeper. Quite frankly, tomatoes I grow, I don't want them to grow any more vigorously than they do. They come up out the top of a 7-foot cage and go over the edge and come back down and touch the ground and keep on growing. So it's certainly true that you can plant them horizontally, but unless you've been forced to settle for some plants who are badly overgrown to begin with, I don't know that I would do it intentionally, if that makes sense.
Yes, sir. Okay. That was my main two questions. Thank you for your time, sir.
It's always a pleasure. You get it and have a good Sunday, Glenn, and call me anytime I can help. And we move along next to Beverly. Good morning, Beverly.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's see, what I'm calling about, first of all, my garden area used to grow plants just really, really well, but now the soil is way too hard. And what can I do to soften that up?
Well, just stay organic in what you do. If you use an organic fertilizers and organic products, your soil should get it softer and softer over time rather than harder. Now, things that will work to soften it when it has gotten hard, you could. There's a product called Medina Plus, which is just an improved form of their soil activator that over time, won't happen with one application, but it will work to soften the soil. Garret juice, which is a concoction. You can either buy it pre-mixed or you can go to Howard's website at dirtdoctor.com, and his formula is right up there so you can create your own. Molasses, either dry molasses or liquid molasses, will work to soften your soil. But above all, just stay away from the synthetic fertilizers, and those things burn the organic material out of the soil, and that's what makes your soil get so hard over time. So, and if you want to soften it the fastest way you possibly can, get some good compost and put a layer of it about an inch deep over the area. Keep that moist, and that will soften your soil very, very quickly. What you want to do is just be sure you keep it soft, which means going on using nothing but organic products on it.
Okay, well, that sounds great. And, you know, another thing, when I have potatoes, they usually start sprouting. But if I put them in the icebox, they don't. Is it bad to put potatoes in the icebox?
Well, don't put them in the freezer. You'll ruin a potato in the freezer, but keeping it in your vegetable crisper is a great way to prolong their shelf life.
Oh, okay. Somebody said that to do that, it'll make them too sweet. It's not good.
No.
Sugar.
No, it's somebody's a little misinformed on that one. You can increase their shelf life. Generally, as long as you keep them cool, they're not going to sprout. They're not going to do a whole lot, but you can certainly ensure that by keeping them. Just don't let them go below freezing. That will destroy a lot of the quality of them.
Oh, great. Then I can just keep them in the icebox. Another thing, we used to have a lot of grass, carpet grass, underneath the oak tree, but now the oak tree has got so big. Now we don't have grass in those areas.
Uh-huh.
What would you suggest to put?
Grass is a waste of time. When it gets real shady, grass just isn't going to grow. If you want something that looks like grass, there is something called dwarf mondo grass or dwarf monkey grass, and it will thrive in the shade of that oak tree and make an absolutely beautiful bed. If you want to plant a little thicker ground cover, there's a plant called Asian jasmine that'll give you a beautiful ground cover underneath that oak tree. And if you want something a little bit bigger, there are plants like Aspidistra, also known as cast iron plant, plants like holly fern, plants like Akuba. There are many different plants that will tolerate the shade, and it just depends on whether you want just a low ground covering or whether you want a little bit bigger garden. There are also some flowers that will do very well. Salvia coccinea, known as tropical sage, will bloom beautifully in an area like that. You've got a world of different possibilities that are a lot more interesting than grass to begin with.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Well, I'm going to try some of those. And my husband said to ask you, he had two pecan trees to die recently, and they was over 20 years old. Why did these pecan trees die?
Probably the drought. You know, people think of pecan trees as being just really tough trees, but we've had, the drought has been so bad in many areas that I'm seeing pecan trees and other trees suffer. And in some cases, gosh, I've seen enormous pecan trees, not so much out in the country. I mean, I've got pecan trees that are, you know, 3.5 feet thick, and they seem to come through all the drought. But in town where people are planting them in a yard where they've gotten a little spoiled, they haven't really spread the roots out because they're getting everything they needed just from the water that the grass and things got. When we get really, really dry and those roots that are way down deep, they really suffer. And I would almost bet you that it's just an issue of drought. It certainly should not be a disease or anything like that.
Okay, so the pecan trees that I do have, I need to start watering them more, right?
At least, you know, if you water briefly, you're helping your grass, but not your trees. If you would once a month turn that hose on, put it, you know, kind of move it around different places around the base of the tree, and just literally, I mean, it'll run up your water bill, and you don't have to do it real often, but if once a month or so you would be able to give those trees a really deep watering, you'll have much healthier trees.
Oh, well, that's a plan. Okay, well, I thank you so much.
If I could give you an example of this, and yeah. I'm very blessed to live on a big piece of land outside of town. I have a creek that runs through that had pecan trees or has pecan trees up and along it. And then I have, 200 yards away in one of my pastures, I've got some absolutely enormous pecan trees. Those pecan trees that were out in the pasture, I mean, those roots probably go to the next county. The pecan trees along the creek got real spoiled because they just always had all the water they needed being close to the creek. In 2011, which was the single worst one-year drought that we'd ever had, I had several trees along the creek just fold up and die because the creek dried up and it stayed dry for, you know, a year or longer, and the pecan trees perished because they didn't have a real widespread root system. My pecan trees that are out in the pasture who have been forced to develop a really big root system to, you know, live the past 100 years, they got through the drought without any problem. So we just have to remember, with everything in our landscapes, if we are getting them accustomed to getting water from us when we get into severe drought, we have to keep watering or we're likely to suffer some severe damage, and that goes all the way up to some of our trees.
Oh, well, boy, oh, that's something good to know. But I really thank you for the information.
You're certainly welcome, Beverly. I appreciate the call this morning. You have a wonderful Sunday. Thanks. I guess we better get a break in here, Chris. We'll be right back and talk to Sarah and Gary.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. It's going to be Sarah and Gary and Sandy and Robin. Sarah is up first. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Bob. It's so nice to talk to you this morning.
My pleasure.
I have a question about, I need some help with the plant selection. I have a hedge along my back lawn between me and my neighbors. We have a chain link fence, and on their side of the yard, they have a variety of plants. I can't quite tell what they are, but some ligustrums. I think there's some hackberries in there. It's sort of a bramble of stuff.
A thicket.
Yeah, exactly, a thicket. And it has beautiful grapevines growing all through it. I'm kind of in downtown Bernie. So half the year, it's a dense hedge. Then when the grape leaves fall, it's pretty sparse. And I'm wanting to fill it in on my side of the yard where there's nothing quite growing. But it's a lot of shade to half of the year. It's a very deep shade the other half of the year. And I'm just not sure what would do pretty well. I need it to get up to at least 6 feet.
Is it fairly sunny, or is this thicket so thick that there's not much light gets through to the ground underneath?
When the grape leaves are growing, it's pretty shaded. During the winter months, after the grape leaves have fallen, it gets some dappled light, but it's still primarily just in the shade.
Okay. I was going to say there are a couple of native vines that you could plant if you just want to have more vines growing through in there, but you want to have some things that kept their leaves. There is a native plant called coral honeysuckle that grows just fine in Bernie. It's not a real thick, dense. It's not an invasive honeysuckle like the Japanese honeysuckle, but you could simply plant some of that and let it become a part of the thicket. You could do the same thing with crossvine. Now, there's an improved form of crossvine called tangerine beauty crossvine. If you come into San Antonio and go down around the Pearl anytime, that's the vine that you see just growing everywhere with all the tangerine orange flowers in the spring. And you could plant some of that and just let it grow up, and it's going to remain evergreen even after the grape drops its leaves. Now, if you wanted to actually plant some big shrubs in there, which would make it even thicker and denser, but things that would hold their leaves through the winter months, loquat is one that you could plant. There are some big viburnums, mirror leaf, chindo. There are a number of big viburnums that are going to grow 6 to 8 feet tall, which are going to remain evergreen. Was talking to a caller earlier about bay leaf, and you know, it's the bay suffered some in that really, really severe winter 2 years ago, but bay is in a beautiful, you know, shrubby plant with obviously some great culinary uses as well. And when you're out of 30 years, it might get some winter damage, but gosh, I've had one for many, many years. I live just west of Bernie, and that would be something else that would be evergreen that would kind of contribute to that sort of thicket look. And then if you wanted to actually get into, you know, creating more of an artistic looking landscape, I can tell you a few other things. But if you just want to basically leave it looking wild, but have some privacy growing there in the winter months, those are all things that I would consider.
Oh, great. I love bay leaf and loquat, but I was concerned with the amount of shade. But I guess if I'm not trying to get a fruit, it would be okay with the loquat.
Well, they will tolerate some shade. They probably, they're not going to have leaves, aren't going to be quite as big or quite as dense. But keep in mind that there are going to be 4 or 5 months out of the year when there are no leaves up there to stop the sun, and they're going to continue growing and photosynthesizing in the winter months when the grape and several of the other things have dropped all their leaves. So they a lot of times sort of store enough energy during the winter months that they make it through the summer when it's shadier.
Okay, and I also have some pittosporum and xylosma in different parts of my yard that I thought about just digging up and moving back there.
Both of those would be fine too.
Okay.
Yeah, both of those would do very well. Once again, I'm just, after, you know, year before last, I just little reluctant about things that have been widely planted that really suffer badly in the freeze. I lost a green pittosporum that the trunk is probably 24 inches across. So, but those things would do well, and that plant had probably been there for 80 years without any damage. Oh, so I guess that's a pretty good long run.
Right, yes. Okay. Well, thank you. I have some great ideas. And I have another question about aphids.
Okay.
I have a stock tank pond. It's just decorative, and it has some goldfish and lily pads.
Uh-huh.
The lily pads are covered with aphids right now. Uh-huh. And I think I've heard you say you could spray with spinosad soap for aphids. Is that correct?
You can. I would probably just go with dormant oil or something like that. And I would just spray very, very lightly. We had at one time a problem with like that on a pond with aphids. And with the fish that we had in there, we added some of the gambusia, some of the mosquito fish, and we would just go through. We did this about for about a week. We went through and would just take and reach down and push that lily pad down under the water and just take our hands and just kind of wash the aphids off into the water, and the fish devoured them very, very quickly. And so we got them under control. Like I say, it took doing this every day for a week, but it totally eliminated the aphids.
Okay, just give them make them fish food.
Yeah, that's
I can do that.
Yeah, that would probably be the easiest and safest thing for your fish.
Okay, I have one last question. I have a beautiful forest pansy redbud that's getting some seed pods on it, and I wanted to know if I could how I could use those seed pods to make some more forest pansy redbud.
Well, unfortunately, the seed from the forest pansy redbud probably is not going to come back as a forest pansy. It was a selection just because of its dark, dark purple leaves and beautiful pink flowers, but its genetics are all mixed up. And that's why the forest pansies are almost exclusively grafted trees. If you collected 100 seed, if you collected 1,000 seed and grew every one of them out, probably one or two of them would be as pretty as your original forest pansies. So it's just, again, when you're dealing with a selected plant like that that is propagated asexually, as they say, that's propagated through cuttings or graftings, that's how they've been able to maintain that beautiful color, is that it's all part of the original plant. When you start mixing things up as you get with seed, you just no guarantees what you're going to get, and you probably not very many of them are going to come out nearly as pretty as your forest pansy.
Okay, well, I'll just enjoy the one I have then.
And do remember to water it through this dry period. Red buds are another one that survive a lot of drought, but in your landscape where it's used to you're getting water, a lot of meteorologists are comparing this year to 2011, which was our single one-year driest year since they've started keeping weather history. So we're going to be talking, if we don't get significant rainfall, we're going to have to do a lot of supplemental watering on landscapes.
And when it's just sort of dreary and drizzly like this, does that really provide any water?
No.
Okay.
It might help the grass a little bit, but it does nothing for our big shrubs and trees.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Bob. I really appreciate it. Have a beautiful
day. It's my pleasure, Sarah. You do the same. Thank you. I believe Gary is next in line now. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Off to a good start. It's a beautiful morning out there.
Oh, yeah. I had a couple of quick questions. I've got a plant I've identified as a desert spoon. Are you familiar with that?
Desert spoon?
Yeah, it's like that's a spiny, long-fronded, cacti-looking thing.
Gosh, I don't know it by that name. It sounds like a cactus. Does it have fairly thick leaves or pads?
No, it's like a palm frond almost,
And I don't suppose you don't have a botanical name for it, do you?
Let me see. It was
I hate to do that to you, but
yeah,
the problem with common names.
Yeah,
but well, ask me your question, and we'll see if we can identify it that way.
When they were put in by the landscaper, I don't know if it was one or two, but now I see there's two of them. They're growing together, and they've got the spines on them, now. Uh-huh. And so I'm wondering if it looks like a Texas sowtoe. It's what it looks like.
Okay.
But it's kind of a paler color. Anyway, the spines that are rubbing against each other, it's kind of, I don't know if it's killing each other or what, but I was going to see if I could split those things. They're about 6 inches apart,
you would have very, very little luck in trying to divide them. They're almost certainly, connected down underground. It's just, it's like an underground trunk. On sowtoles and also on some of the agaves, this description also, matches pretty closely some of the agaves that have a lot of spines up and down the side of a very flat leaf as well. But they tend to be joined at a single point at the base that you just really, really can't split without probably losing both plants. So if you like it, I'd say enjoy it. If you want to get in there and trim it up a little bit, you can probably at least slow down some of that damage because, you get the kind of wind that we've had the past couple of weeks. They're going to tear up each other. In the case of the agaves, I've known people to go in and just clip the spines off where they were either posing a threat to things walking by it or where they were, rubbing back and forth and just tearing things up. It doesn't hurt the plant at all to clip that spine off, and if you restricted it just to the area where the damage is occurring, it probably wouldn't be all that noticeable. So a couple of different options here, but I really don't think dividing is one of them. Now, if you wanted to, you could dig down 3 or 4 inches deep and just cut one of them off and discard it. That would not hurt the one that was left behind, and it would continue to grow. But there's okay. not really a way to salvage both plants if that was your intention.
Yeah, okay. I've got the name is Dasylirion.
Yeah, Dasylirion. Yeah, it is a sowtoe. Sowtoe is actually Dasylirion sowtoe, and it's just a different Dasylirion, and no chance at all of trying to divide it. There are many different species of it. If you know Sotol, it makes that bloom spike that's about 6 or 8 feet tall.
Right.
And we used to, my summer's in West Texas in a wildlife management area. There's another Sotol out there that its bloom spike's only about 2 feet tall. So you know what we called it. That was Dazzlerian, not Sotol. But so anyway, closely related. You did a great job of comparing it to a Sotol, but there would be no chance of splitting that plant in half.
Okay.
You could eliminate half of it if you wanted to, but no way you're going to make two plants out of it.
Okay. And one more quick question about Esperanza. You can take a cutting from that, have I read that, and try to start another one?
You can do that. In fact, if you do it really in early summer, because they are woody plants, it takes a little longer to root. I would soak your cuttings. Keep your cuttings very short. It needs to be mature wood. Keep your cuttings down to maybe 3 or 4 inches. Soak them in some garret juice or liquid seaweed. And you will root them in perlite. You're going to have to keep them in a shady spot, and you may end up, wetting them down 3 or 4 times a day to keep them from dehydrating too badly. But that way, I mean, the commercial people do it. They've got them sitting on a bench where they automatically come on and mist them 6 times an hour for 12 hours out of the day. But the other thing that you can do is wait a little later in the summer until it really warms up. And you can take a bigger branch on this plant, and we do what's called an air layer. If you want to Google that, and you actually see pictures of the process. But we take a knife and just kind of scrape the bark or cut the bark off one side of one of the stems for a length of about 3 or 4 inches. Then we take some moist, long-fibered sphagnum moss, kind of stuff they used to line hanging baskets, wrap a handful of that around this area that we've damaged on the stem, and then tie that up very tightly, either with aluminum foil or with plastic wrap, and just leave it sit there for about 6 weeks. And what will happen is the plant will put roots out into that sphagnum moss, and then you can go back, unwrap, take the plastic or the foil off, clip it off below that clump of moss, and what you've got in effect is a pre-rooted cutting. And you can do that easily with Esperanza. You can do that with, rubber plants, ficus trees. Not every plant can be done that way, but Esperanza would be very easy. If you had a big plant, you could put 6, 8, 10 different air layers on there, and it's virtually 100% successful because you're letting the cutting root before it cuts away from the mother plant. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I might try that then.
Look up air layer. It's a little hard to explain exactly how you do it on the radio. It'd be a lot easier on TV. But if you're really interested in doing it where you don't have to be giving it daily attention, you can just put your air layer on it. If you wrap it tightly, the moss is going to hold the moisture, and then all you got to do is go back 6 weeks later, be sure it's formed the roots, cut it away, and you got a new plant ready to go.
All right. Well, that sounds good. I appreciate your help this morning. Thank you.
Well, always a pleasure. I appreciate the call this morning.